New Yorker article, is that big oil companies like BP and Exxon were against Icahn's change, and they started pushing back really hard. And so Icahn,
we have to leave it there.
Yes.
We're going to do part two of our discussion. Tyson Slocum of Public Citizen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house gathering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse.
Okay. All right. Stop the music. Okay. This is KBOO 90.7 your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. I'm Joe. Abe isn't here. I'm going to do a little history talk. I hope you don't mind, and I'm certainly going to get you on the air if I can. I want you to be patient through this because it's really important. What happened in Charlottesville would be inexplicable without a careful and serious analysis of history post-Civil War. So I'm going to do a little of that, and it's going to get a little crowded because it's a lot of information. So you be patient, please. And I know if you know all this stuff, you might say, come on. But I'm beginning to feel that many people may not realize exactly why or how this is possible, this incredible revision of new nationalism, racism, anti-Semitism, etc., that has gone on with this big march. But the big march was not a singular event. It was one of many events and probably one of a potentially triumphant march toward fascism. So I want to spend some time on this. I'm Joe. As I say, Abe isn't here. Let's go through this stuff, and I want you to be patient. First of all, after the Civil War, the decisions that were made were key to not treating the South as an occupied country in the extremes that would have been characteristic of previous civil uprisings in Europe, for example. So one of the things that happened was there was an attempt at first, and this was a lot of Lincoln's thinking before he was assassinated, was to kind of ease the states back into place and just to kind of create the idea that this was a fight not about the liberation of African Americans, but more a fight between brothers and sisters of the Caucasian persuasion. Now, this this mythology, this idea, was popular because it made it possible to reorganize the Union as though the horrors of this enormous struggle, the Civil War, never really happened. But what did happen was a disjunction in which the old planter class faced a great deal of threat. And the response to this, and I'm going to be very brief in this history, but and therefore leave things out. But what really happened, and this is very important, was that the first response was to create a reestablishment of the states of the South under President Johnson, the first President Johnson, who was impeached and very nearly thrown out of office. But what he did and what happened at that point was basically to try to go back to the old normal as if it were a new normal. Now, that meant a lot of different things. One thing it meant was the establishment of something called black codes. These were laws that essentially, while African Americans had been emancipated, put them in a position of absolute indebtedness and absolute requirement, using essentially laws against vagrancy, to force African Americans, particularly African American males, to work for the old master class or anyone else who had the money to pay them the minimal wages or the sharecropping system, under the sharecropping system, to essentially force these people into involuntary servitude. In other words, not hereditary slavery, but in essence, slavery. Very important to realize and very important to think about in terms of what we're looking at today. Now, the reason why I'm running through this history, and I hope I'm not boring people and I hope I'm not repeating stuff that everybody knows, but even so, it's not bad to look at it, is because of what happened in Charlottesville. It would be inexplicable and is being treated as if it was an aberration, an unusual aberration in American history. Unfortunately, while very dramatic and horrible and murderous, it is not. The tradition of white violence against persons of color and against, by the way, Jewish people, and in the 1920s, Catholics as well, this tradition, put forward largely by the Ku Klux Klan, but also by other so-called nationalists, essentially was an outgrowth of the changes that were forced upon the South, initially upon the South, by the loss of the Civil War. I think there's nothing more important in our history than that war and that struggle and the liberation of persons of color. And I think that the effort to stop that, to block it, to limit it, is a dominant fixture in American history. Not the dominant fixture, but a dominant fixture. So Andrew Johnson, who was the vice president that Lincoln had chosen in 1864, essentially was a gesture toward the South. He was from Tennessee. He was one of the few people in Congress who did not join the Confederacy. And essentially what he did was issue a series of proclamations which reestablished normalcy, I put quotes around that, in the South. Now, if this is similar to what Donald Trump does today, yeah, proclamations, right. And this era is called, in historians' terms, presidential reconstruction. It runs from 1865 to 67. There was an attempt, and almost successful, to kick Johnson out of office. And what that involved was white state conventions throughout the South, abolishing slavery, repudiating secession, and not paying the Confederate debt. But at the same time, the creation of something called black codes, which made marriage legal for African Americans, gave them property rights and access very limited to the courts. For example, African Americans could not testify against whites. No jury service was allowed for African Americans. No voting or militia membership. So basically, a quasi-slave state being established. And the most important part of this economically was the requirement, these vagrancy laws that I mentioned earlier, that required African-American men particularly, but also women, to be employed and to agree to contracts that were not necessarily favorable, working for the planter class and others. If there was resistance to that, these people would be taken to court and essentially forced to work for others. So in other words, they were not free. By the way, the use of vagrancy laws was a powerful device to control all kinds of people, not just African Americans, throughout much of the country's history until more modern times. Very important point. And also, Blacks could not testify against whites. They could not have jury service and so on. So second class at best citizenship. This is about the same period of time that during the Civil War, promises had been made to African Americans in Georgia, Sea Islands, and elsewhere that they would get 40 acres and a mule in reparation for slavery. This, of course, was erased, done away with. And where it had actually been instrumentally enacted, it was taken away. So a betrayal of the hopes and the dreams of African Americans in consequence to having freedom was absolutely wiped out. This is very significant. These labor contracts were an incredible device to oppress. The labor contract system evolved eventually into the plantation system in which black people, African Americans, were essentially contracted to be sharecroppers, to work on a contract agreement in which they would receive a share of the profit of that which they grew. And they were indebted forever in that process. In reaction to this, there was a movement of radical Republicans, essentially Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens and others, attempting to give ex-slaves land. At the same time, in 1862, during the Civil War, there was the Homestead Act, which opened up the West to farming, and you had to prove land out, and then you got to keep it. And that, of course, was a way to destroy the autonomy of nations of Native Americans. The Freedmen's Bureau was also created after the war, and the Civil Rights Bill. So U.S. citizens suddenly had rights, and this was an effort to stop these so-called black codes. So what really happened was that the poorer persons in the South, regardless of their color, were put in a situation of involuntary servitude. And this was a way to reestablish power for the old ruling plantation class. At the same time, opportunists, called carpet baggers, moved into the South and bought lands of people who had gone broke during the war. So you have a changing in the guard to some degree. And consequence of this, you begin to see, beginning in 1866, the rise of a white fascist. Fascist is the wrong word because there wasn't that concept then, but essentially a white authoritarian, racially motivated control of persons of color. The Knights of the White Camellia being one example, and the Ku Klux Klan created in 1866 in Tennessee. By the way, the Klan did not have the white sheets until the revival of the Klan back in the 1900s. So, you know, our images are very significantly wrong. And I want to make this clear. Then there was a movement which was called the Redeemers, which you began to see throughout the South, in Tennessee, in North Carolina, in Texas, eventually in states like Mississippi and South Carolina. This was in 1876. And that movement became a very powerful movement, which brought large numbers of voters. And these were mostly people now excluded from the polls, mostly poor whites and black people. And in the election of 1876, I'm just jumping way fast here, and I apologize for that, but a lot of you are probably going to want to call in. There was the election of 1876. This was Hayes versus Tilden. Hayes was the Republican. Tilden was the Democrat. In South Carolina and Florida and Louisiana, there was an indication of Republican support. In 1877, a corrupt bargain was made, and this was kind of the end of Reconstruction in the South. Now, in 1873, there was a serious economic recession or depression, and more of the Northern concerns turned away from the question of freedom for African Americans, turned away from the question of how to control the South or build a new nation, and more to dealing with the industrial changes that were underway. So this corrupt bargain essentially threw the election into the hands of Congress. The Democrats, in consequence, got control of the South. All troops would be out of the South, which ended any effort to allow or to give black people freedom in the region. It ended the Freedmen's Bureaus, which had been created after the Civil War to help people learn to read and to write, to establish schools, to establish hospitals, to establish services for the poor, and particularly for African Americans. There was also an agreement to have a railroad, a southern route to California, called the Texas and Pacific Railroad, which was never built. Meanwhile, Hayes, the Republican, got the presidency, and the Democrats got the South. So by 1900, the South was solidly Democrat and solidly white-controlled. I'm really jumping fast. So you saw post-1870s that there were no hospitals for ordinary folks, no schools. All of this was taken away. The tax system was reconstructed in such a manner that basically there were no services for poor people, and there were frequent, routinized, culturally acceptable lynchings in the South and in the Midwest. By 1900, there were no public high schools for persons of color in the South. And there began to be a revisionist history of nostalgia for the Civil War. As I said a little bit earlier, there was this kind of romanticization that actually the war was a fight among white brothers and sisters. The role of slavery, the role of African Americans was dismissed in this model. And the culture turned to a highly romanticized image of the South. And this was, you know, very, very common, tremendous nostalgia, a quarrel among whites. And in this period of time, you begin to see a new Klan rising, a Klan dominated by nostalgia, and the Klan that was essentially very different. It was not only in the South. It was largely in the West and northern states, particularly in the northern plains or central part of the country. This new Klan was extremely anti-Semitic and anti-Catholic. And in the election of Woodrow Wilson, you see the rise of a legitimization of a basically racist United States. There were 150 killed in a riot in East St. Louis in 1917, anti-black. Until the Civil Rights Movement, there were no riots led by African Americans. They were riots led by whites against African Americans. The second Klan, which gained enormous power in the 1920s, in states like Oregon, by the way, would have gained control of state legislatures and would enforce laws, for example, against parochial schools. In Oregon, there was a law actually passed that made it against the law for anyone to wear priestly or nunnish garments and teach in public schools. It made it against the law to have parochial schools. It was a direct attack against Catholicism. And it was part of a movement, as I say, which was very anti-Semitic, as well as being anti-African-American, as well as being anti-Catholic. And the most archetypal example of this in popular culture, which most of you know about, was a book published, very popular book published, called The Klansman by a guy named Dixon in 1905. That evolved into a movie, the most successful movie of its time, and a very great bit of cinematography, Birth of a Nation, which romanticized the Klan as a savior of white decency and used white actors in blackface to represent African Americans as insanely sexualized and weird. Now, It's hard to remember this, but it's important. Oregon was a state that, in getting admitted to the Union prior to the Civil War, essentially in a compromise between slave and anti-slave forces, agreed to exclude African Americans from a membership in the state of Oregon, from citizenship, and in fact passed laws that would allow the punishment, physical punishment, often whipping, if an African American stayed around too long. Now, these are important things. This romantic idea of the Civil War, the romanticization of a white culture as a model for the United States, the creation of essentially a notion of white physical and intellectual superiority. These did not die. We like to think of them as passing. But if you look at any detailed history of the United States, and even after World War II, you see very quickly, with all the other things that were going on, the genocide, the final genocide of Native Americans, the behavior toward Jews, the lynchings that were common in the South well into the Civil Rights Movement, you begin to see a pattern, not just of racism, but of a morally justified, spiritually actuated, fundamentalistly Christian movement that could today be like Bannon's, I guess it is, Bannon's new nationalism. That force brought together in Charlottesville neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, and other forces of racism that were clearly not just anti-African-American, not just pro-white, quote-unquote, but in fact anti-Semitic. And this is a new phenomenon in its coming out, as it were, not a new phenomenon in our history. I'm really abbreviating here because I want to give some of you a chance to call. But remember that this event in Charlottesville was not a funny, isolated uniqueness. It was, in fact, the ultimate, the ultimate bursting of the sore of racism and anti-Semitism and, to some degree, sexism, and of a new kind of nationalism that has been promoted by the current administration. The election of Donald Trump as president, a barely legitimized election, created the opportunity for these forces to come out of the woodwork and display themselves. But they are not new. They have existed for a long, long time, and they are part of our history, like it or not. So I just wanted to make that clear. I hope that we do not have any more exhibits of this kind of mass movement, but I'm not sure that they won't be. And this is a struggle in which all of us have a stake. It was good to see the positive reactions against this movement all over the United States, including in Portland. But this is a struggle that will continue for a long, long time. And I don't know how it can be resolved, because the mythologies and the fundamentalism behind the mythologies and the racism behind the mythologies is persistent and is powerful. And in the face of economic reversals and the failure of the working class to be able to gain legitimate wages since the 1960s, all of these feed into this pattern. I would love to hear from you and your comments on what happened. And let's revisit these issues with a certain sense of grace and anger. 231-8187. And while you're thinking about that, let's think about this. If the Bannonites can still dominate the thinking of a person like Donald Trump, whose family comes out of a tradition of racism. Remember, Donald Trump's father became extremely wealthy in the real estate business, in the process of which he largely excluded African Americans from housing in projects which were frequently publicly funded. The pattern of racism within that family is very, very strong. And it is very ironic, actually, that Trump's bright daughter married a Jewish wealthy realtor, real estate man, and is has been characterized by the neo-Nazis as somewhat of a race betrayer. This is the weird environment in which we are functioning now. The news, the general news services are not apparently able to really look at these issues with any realistic attitude. The only really good analysis I've seen in mass media actually are on Vice News, which has done an excellent job of reporting on this and kind of showing exactly who these people are. It is not something that can be dismissed, and it is not something that can be thought of as an aberration, unfortunately. This is still the same defiant, racist model that was produced by the loss of the Civil War in the South. Let's get some phone calls going. We have Helen. Helen, you're on the air.
Hi, Joe. I just want to say thank you, and what would we do without you? You are just so important to KBOO, and you do such a wonderful job.
Well, no, I'm not. But
yes, you are.
Thank you.
Know, no. Don't say that. We are always being educated by you, and we should all be so grateful for you. I just wanted to say that.
Okay, where's the money?
I'll send a check tomorrow.
To KBOO.
Yeah, no. All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Well, I don't know. I'm not good with compliments, and I thank you, but really, seriously, if you like the programming we're doing, if you like the programming others are doing, you should be supporting this station with as much money as you can afford. This station is probably one of the, well, maybe two, another one as well, but basically the stations that are giving you as much truth and accuracy about what's going on. And, you know, having Amy Goodman and so on is really important. And that cannot happen. It cannot happen without your support. Well, enough on that. I want to hear from you, 231-8187. We're concentrating on the historic reasons for the Charlottesville March of the Nazis, unified now with the with the pro-Confederate KKK crowd, and the enormous degree of racism that simmers just beneath the surface in many of our communities. Who do we have now? James?
Morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting that, you know, there's a lot of people who are marching that aren't who are marching with the Confederates that aren't, or the alt-right, as they want to call them. There's a lot of people who are marching that aren't necessarily themselves white, but they identify as white. And I think that's something that we have not really addressed.
I understand what you're saying. Are you saying, for example, that African Americans were marching in that crowd? Because I saw none.
No, I'm talking about, I mean, not necessarily at the march itself, but I'm talking about there's a huge underlying problem within communities of color that has to do with colorism. You know, there's a lot of...
Well, that's true, but I don't... I have to interrupt you here. I don't see that as an issue within what happened at in Charlottesville, and I don't...
It ties into a larger issue of people trying to find legitimacy, because a lot of these groups... They will have people who aren't necessarily like as what we would term as white, but they're light skinned and white identifying, who benefit from white supremacy because they have light skin, and will ultimately defend these racist groups. And those types of people
where are you coming up with this? Because I just don't see it. I don't experience it.
Remescla posted it was like a op-ed, I guess, and there was this guy who was a Puerto Rican descent who's carrying around, I mean, he's very white passing, he's a Puerto Rican descent, carries around a Confederate flag and says, well, you know, there's a lot of racist Puerto Ricans out there, but I'm not one. But he's a guy who's white passing,
I don't quite understand the sourcing here. I don't know whether or not there are people who are so race-oriented that this would be a significant thing for them. I don't think it's an issue of any great consequence. I think that the fact of the matter is that what has happened is a kind of merging of racist, racialist attitudes about this inherent, the supposed inherent superiority of the Anglo-Saxon peoples. By the way, when I talk about that, I also should mention the fact that during the period leading up to and during World War I, there was an enormous anti-German sentiment. And previous to that, going way, way back, there was the anti-Masonic movement, and there was as well a very strong anti-Irish movement. So we have always had these movements which argue for something which is some kind of weird, pure Americanism, which is basically a kind of Anglo-Saxon notion, and not something that comes out of any historical validity, but is populist and very, very ugly. That has off and on reared its head. But in fact, this march in Charlottesville clearly was a very successful effort, successful in the sense of showing up a large number of people with tiki torches, of all things, and leading to murder, essentially a movement which seemed to be uniting the neo-Nazi movements with the KKK. And remember that the Ku Klux Klan became incredibly powerful during the 1920s. Oregon had so significant a Klan, as I mentioned earlier, that it was able to pass legislation against Catholics here. The fact of the matter is that these movements, these reactionary fascist and neo-fascist movements, have always existed and become more or less powerful depending on the economic conditions of working people. This is a very serious problem, and it can't be just dismissed. I don't know anything about this issue of passing people. I don't think it's a significant factor myself. 231-8187. David, you're on the air.
Hi, I enjoyed your summary of the history there. I think it shed some light.
It was a little too fast, but yeah.
Well, necessarily. There's a phenomenon in psychology where if you have naive sexual suppress them, they come out in pathological ways. And as a basically liberal modern human, I've been shocked to see the lack of shame involved in these racist attitudes emerging, just as I was kind of shocked when capitalism came out under Reagan. You know, like greed was suddenly not shameful, it was okay. But I think I would like to see these people pushed back into their caves, but they'll pop out again, you know, if we don't deal with it. The psychological parallel is that you have to talk openly about these things, unpleasant as they are, in order to avoid them to keep them from becoming pathological. And my thought is that the presence of Confederate statue at least kept something in the public eye that you could talk about. You could point at a statue of Stonewall Jackson and say, yes, he may have been a great field commander, but he was fighting for the wrong cause. Or you could say Confederate soldiers were brave, but they were fighting on the wrong side. How do you keep this racist element out of mainstream culture and out of the halls of power, and yet acknowledge them sufficiently so that they don't fester in secret and burst forth as they did in Charlottesville?
You're asking a good question. I'm going to try to address some of that, and I appreciate the call. I do want to talk a little bit about the statues and this whole argument, which was the tipping point, or rather the rationalization for this anger that we saw in Charlottesville. Here's the deal. The statues did not exist prior to 1900. They began to appear during this romanticization of the Old South and the creation of the notion of the brothers fighting each other and the absolute ignoring of the situation of slavery and post-slavery for African Americans. The erection of the statues was a romanticization within the context of this weird Anglo-Saxon mythos. And the statues themselves are absolutely objects of dishonesty and distortion. One such statue in Central Park in New York is of a doctor who is considered the father of modern American gynecology, who in fact, in order to help women, took African-American women, slaves, and tortured them and hurt them without any anesthetics in the process of trying to figure out what were the problems with childbirth. Yeah, he made advances in science, much in the same way that one could argue the Nazis did. This guy has a statue in Central Park. I do not say get rid of the statues. I say take them to the appropriate location. In the case of in the South of these various military quote-unquote heroes, I say, okay, put them at the Confederate graveyard. Put them at a place where if you want to worship them, you can go worship them, but not at the town square, not at the center of the power in the states. They don't belong. They do not belong in the American tradition, because if there is anything worthwhile to American culture, it has to be based on a progressivist, egalitarian image. If it's based on racism, if it's based on a system that romanticizes slavery, if it's based on a system that oppresses peoples based on who they are or on their class origin, that is very dangerous and very stupid and not going to do much good in the world. Anyway, that's where I'm at on the statues. And I really believe that they all should be taken down, if not destroyed, then placed in places where they belong. And that would, for example, as I said earlier, be in a Confederate cemetery, because they are statues of what deserves to be dead. The romanticization of this, the creation of the idea, which Trump actually said, of these beautiful statues being destroyed. And then, by the way, I want to mention this, he turned the whole question around and said, well, what do we do? Do we do away with the statues of Jefferson and Washington? Because, after all, they were slaveholders. Pardon me. That absolutely ignores the fact that most of the statuary, in fact, all of it, as far as I know, is a romanticization of the oppression of African Americans in the struggle of the Civil War. And in fact, Washington and Jefferson, for all their faults, and there were many, and their slaveholding and so on. By the way, Washington actually freed his slaves before his death, though Jefferson did not. He liked wine too much, didn't want to give up his wealth. The fact of the matter is that Washington and Jefferson created, along with many others, a new and viable idea of democracy in America. So what Trump does is confuse one thing with another, and in the process distorts history totally. 231-8187. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey there, Jim. Joe. You hear me okay?
Yeah.
So I was just going to mention something about the statues. The other station, National Public Relations, anyway, they have come out with dribs and grabs of the history, which you were just talking about. But one was a Harvard historian talking about the statues being built and placed in, I thought it was 1890 to 1920.
Well, that's the period of time. I used the turn of the century as the marker, but indeed some of them were put in the late 1800s.
Right. But they were, from what this historian was saying, it was intimidation, and no question about that. The other thing I heard this morning, that a lot of those statues were funded by the Daughters of the Confederacy.
Right.
And see, this is what National Public Relations does. They come out with dribs and drabs, and they have these short segments, and they don't do the long form anymore, and that's my main criticism.
Well, that's a very good point. In fact, one of the things that we have with the mass media nowadays is the absolute dumbing down of the analysis.
Yep.
And that is very easy and more pleasing to the ear, but absolutely inadequate to an analysis of what's really going on. I want to thank you.
Yeah. And
Go ahead.
We're all too stupid, and so we got to do short segments. And
well, it's kind of insulting. I agree.
Oh, easy. Bingo bongo.
Okay, man. I'm going to let you go. Give someone else an opportunity.
Yeah. Thanks, Bud Joe.
Sure. Steve. All right, 231-8187. I tried with my way too much simplicity and briefness to talk about the post-Civil War period and the reversal of the attempts to create equality for African Americans. I want to make a couple of points really clear here. Promises were made to African Americans that they would get, quote-unquote, 40 acres and a mule. Spike Lee uses that failure as a symbol for his movie making. The betrayal was real. In the Georgia Sea Islands, people, African Americans, lost their land, which had been granted to them by the Army during the Civil War. The fact of the matter is that there were real efforts, finally, to bring African Americans into the struggle as soldiers. That was resisted enormously in the North as well as in the South. Always, the picture that you get when you really look at the history of the United States is of a nation who operated in the assumption of the inherent superiority of the so-called Anglo-Saxon race. The genocide from the very beginning of Native Americans, the legitimization from the very beginning, from the very Constitution itself, of slavery. All of this is real. All of this is our heritage, and all of it needs to be rectified and has not yet been done. And this is the ongoing struggle of the civil rights movement. The reaction that we're seeing right now, really led by the jerk in chief, is terrifying and is very much a part of a reaction to efforts to create equality in our society. The ignoring of the fact that working people, whether they're called middle class or working class, the fact of the matter is that working people's incomes have not in any way kept up with what they had earned in the 50s and 60s, and that has a lot to do with the smashing of organized labor. That's another force and another factor that needs to be considered in our analysis. So I'm throwing these things out. It's a lot of stuff. But I think it's all important, and I think we all need to look at it. I hope you want to allow me to continue with this. 231-8187. Jim, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I do appreciate the fact that you and your cohort do have good views of both sides, and often that comes up. And I would just like to have you sometime soon go into the nature of the Antifa movement and the anarchists and show their side too, because they can be a danger to our democracy too, as you know.
Well, I'm not sure how they're a danger to democracy. I think their strategy may be questionable.
Yeah, sure. No, that's it. I would like you just in some time in the near future maybe talk about them and show what we have to watch out for that too. And then also you know, America and the Christian European countries, they were late comers to the slave trade when you go back to Rome and the
tradition that goes back in time.
Yeah, way back. And in fact, at, you know, 1808, the Congress did actually abolish the slave trade in USA.
Yes.
So sometime in the near future, too, it'd be nice to say some good things about our nation, because it's not all bad.
Well, no, I'm not suggesting that America is inherently bad, only that it's inherently racist.
Well, yeah, whenever it is, it would be nice to have some good stuff on the other side, too, as well. And
okay.
So I appreciate you guys and keep it up.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks very much for the call. I guess I should briefly address the issue of the anti-fascist movement. I had been initially very, very critical of the Black Bloc. I thought their tactics, not their goals, were terrible. And I still am concerned about that. But having seen the function of it in rescuing people during the fascist attacks in Charlottesville, I have to rethink it. You have to deal, while favoring nonviolence, you have to deal with the reality of people whose intent is murder and destruction and harm to other individuals. You know, this is really something that has to be addressed. I don't want to see fighting in the streets a la the Nazis in the 1920s and 30s in Germany. But I also think this hiding oneself behind a mask and so on, a little scary. But the fact of the matter is that the anti-fascist movement is the spear point of a struggle against these fascists and their intentions. So I don't want to be dismissive the way I was in the past. And I want to think about the issue as a more nuanced and complex issue. This is my personal view. I want to get us back to focusing on the history of the United States post-Civil War and the fact of it. And the fact that, for example, the statuary that's being argued about really has its origins in the late 1800s and early 1900s in an attempt to romanticize and Anglo-Saxonize the struggle for the maintenance of slavery. And the fact that the South was able to keep African-Americans down and still has created a situation in which the African-American in America is at far more great a danger. African-Americans are disproportionately attacked and put in prison and so on. We really do not have egalitarian system yet. And the same is true for women and so on. And the anti-Semitism suddenly appearing is very, very interesting. All of this is really about the establishment of a mythic country, which is Anglo-Saxon and pure and good and Christian. I want to hear from you, 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Joe. I like your idea about putting the statuary into the cemeteries.
That's well, since Trump feels it's all so beautiful, why not put it in a cemetery of the dead of the war?
Exactly. Your point is well taken, that the glorification of war tends to ignore the bloody trampling of all of those who actually
died
underneath the hoof of the ones who sent them into battle, as it were. And the people that are glorified are typically the ones who, were sending the common man to die, which touches upon your point about the loss of living wage, union jobs. Would you, I've mentioned before, but in Zinn's history, People's History of the United States, he talks about the conscious promulgation, the creation of the intentional creation of the racism as the outlet. So that, because if poor whites and poor blacks join together and see each other as brothers in arms, which we actually are and should be and should see each other as, we would substantially change the system so that there was a more equitable distribution.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that book emphasized is the way in which class-based politics, which is legitimate and is important, is disarmed by the emphasis, the cultural emphasis on issues of personhood, issues of race, issues of sex, and so on.
It's my personal opinion that identity politics actually, there is legitimacy to the observations of identity politics, but are altogether too frequently, it trumps class analysis.
Well, I think that's true, and I love the use of the term trumps.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks a lot for the call, man.
You betcha.
All right, 231-8187. What I'm trying to do now is, in this brief analysis, make sure that people understand that the post-Civil War period was a period of absolute repression for African Americans, and by the way, for poor whites as well in the South, and the establishment of an order which controlled the behavior and the lives of persons of color. Really important fact, and the reaction to the success of the liberation, almost success of the liberation of African Americans, is in fact at root of the revisionist new neo-Nazi phenomenon, which is absolutely supported by Donald Trump. Who do we have? Francis, you're on the air.
Hi, I had just been thinking of Howard Lynn's People's History of the United States just when your caller mentioned him.
Howard Zinn, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But one thing that in this history that we don't realize and recognize, I really do think from this discussion it's very clear that some way, somehow, we need to have a national commission or whatever, Truth and Reconciliation, because a lot of these truths are not talked about or discussed in a manner in which people can see other opinions.
Well, Francis, I think that's actually an interesting idea, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but unlikely to happen. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
One thing I would like to mention is that the no one ever received the 40 acres and the mule, and our community had been criminalized. And I would refer people to Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Yes, it's very good.
Mass incarceration in the age of colorblindness.
Yes.
And also, those statues, I'm beginning to think that what we need to do is release all the people who from prison who have been massively incarcerated over the years and put those statues behind those prison walls and start dealing with the truth and reconciliation and restorative justice. And the statues in the prison walls can kind of crumble together.
Wait, you want to put the statues in the prison?
Right. That's
literally?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, I wouldn't object.
Let the people out first.
Well, yeah, I understand.
And if anybody wants to go see those statues.
I just think it's sort of funny.
They can go behind the walls of the prisons that they built to incarcerate people who should not be there.
Well, first of all, I want to be clear that I absolutely agree with you about what's happened to persons of color and poor people and Hispanics in the prison system, and that, in fact, the 15th Amendment
and while we have these,
and the 14th Amendment, essentially, well, I should say the 14th Amendment. Let me just finish this. The 14th Amendment really creates a situation where large numbers of people can be jailed for
that
whatever
was the
13th crimes.
Amendment.
Well,
that ended slavery. The 14th Amendment was supposed to remedy that, but the only people that took advantage of that were corporations to demand equal rights of people. The 14th Amendment was supposed to remedy the problems with the 13th Amendment.
Right.
And it did not, because it hasn't been ever enforced properly. It's been used to give corporations people status.
Well, I in a way, you're right. I'm looking right now at the 13th Amendment, and it says it allows persons to be essentially given involuntary servitude, which is prison.
If they're criminals.
If they're duly convicted. And there's nothing there that gives them manumission.
As a result of that, about, I think it was 3 years later, the 14th Amendment was passed just because that was being used that way. And people of color were not being given equal protection under the law. So the 14th Amendment was supposed to remedy that, but has never been used properly or applied properly.
Okay.
Ever.
Thank you very much for the call.
You guys take care.
You take care. 231-8187. I gave a brief, if you're just tuning in, I gave a brief, too brief, history of the Reconstruction era up through, World War One. By the way, I want to mention in the context of World War One was the device by which the left was attacked and essentially delegitimized during that war and after that war. The fact of the matter is that Woodrow Wilson, who has been lionized in a variety of ways, was a racist and was essentially, when he capitulated to have us enter World War One, was essentially getting in line with the rest of the imperial powers. And the United States, of course, did function as an imperialist power throughout the 19th and into the 20th century. Even now, Puerto Rico is not a state and not allowed to be essentially a part of the United States. And the same is true with Guam and several other places. It's really important to understand that the process of legitimization and equality is incomplete and will probably remain incomplete for our lifetimes. And this is a great sin. And it's really, really significant, particularly for the people of those places. The other part of this is, again, the fact that we ignored the reality of class as well as the question of caste, which is to say race. And these issues are buried, deeply buried, in what we teach our children and what we hear in the popular media. 231-8187. Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm interested in the conversation in that I think when we talk about historical context and then how we present facts from different sides, it's very important that when we look at, like, say, the Reconstruction era, mm-hmm. that after slavery, that really what came out of that was the same discriminatory policies, but in, I guess, a more polite way, per se, that really boils down to economics. And that every time we see, I guess, white America, per se, not doing as well as they should be, politically, it's because some other group is taking from them. And I think that this, that when we talk about today's violence against people, say running them over with cars, shooting them in churches, and so on and so forth, I think all we have to do is even go back to something not as recent, but say the Tulsa riots, in which the black community of Tulsa was completely destroyed by whites who were upset with the fact that there were blacks who were doing better than they were. So I think that every single time this economic tool is used, racism and economics are combined, we end up with moments like this. But it's very valuable, because out of moments like this, we find, a brighter side. And it's, I guess, our equality, as for me as an African American, is going to take a long time to arrive when we have a system that is built around the very premise of discrimination.
No, I think you're absolutely racism. I think you're absolutely right. I'm glad you mentioned the Tulsa riot. It was the first instance of using bombs and machine guns against African Americans in the United States. So it's kind of amazing in that sense. And it's not much talked about. So I do appreciate that. I also think that it's important to understand that what Trump is doing by marginalizing immigrants, particularly people whose faith is Islam, what he's doing with that is the same thing that was done with these anti-foreigner movements in the 1920s, in the late 1800s, and so on, and in earlier times in the 1800s. It's all the same game, and it's all a way, essentially, whether intended or not, and I think it more often than not is intended, to take away the main and significant fundamental fact of class in America. And I really appreciate your call, man.
Thank you.
Take care. 231-8187. Okay, Bob, you're going to have to make it quick.
What I wanted to do is supplement your history by focusing on the relationship between the racist white dominance and voting rights. Because beginning with 1866 and 1868, blacks actually took over a number of state legislatures in the South.
Yes.
And for the first time, they established universal public education, which did not exist in the South before the Civil War.
That's true.
And they also imposed property taxes on the landowners, which were the slaveholders, for the first time, to pay for the public education.
That's absolutely true.
And the way the whites responded to that was to establish the Ku Klux Klan in order to terrorize blacks not to vote, so as to eliminate the power that the blacks had gained by being able to vote for the first time in history. And one of the responses to that, of course, was that Andrew Johnson, the president, was supporting those efforts to, in a sense, terrorize blacks. And the Republicans in the Congress, the reverse of today, passed the Voting Rights Amendment to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
In order to ensure that blacks would preserve the right to vote that they had gained after the Civil War. And what we see today is a reversal, again, of the voting rights of blacks and minorities being initiated by state legislators all across the South in order to reduce the power of minorities to protect themselves.
You're absolutely right.
The manifestation of racism is with us in the form of attacking voting rights. It's the same story all over again 150 years later.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, the attack on voting rights, which is a massive movement led by people like Trump, is very frightening and very possibly successful in the future. It's very important.
But if we're going to attack racism, it's not the statutes, it's the statutes that are being used to deprive minorities of voting rights.
I think you're right, and that's a great way of looking at it. I think the issue of the statues is purely symbolic, but used, because it's symbolic, used for all kinds of reasons. And I really appreciate your mentioning those things. I didn't do enough about them. So thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay. I think we're kind of out of time. Yeah, we are. I want to say I really appreciated the conversation. I hope my little mini lecture was, I know it was not adequate, but I also hope that it was informative for many of us. And probably I won't be doing that too often, because I like to have the show be really a talk radio show. And I want to thank you all and urge you to keep tuned to KBOO, because remember, it's not just the best in public affairs, it's the best in music as well.
Nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Join KBOO every Friday at 5:30 p.m. for Counterspin, a show that provides a critical examination of major media stories and exposes what the mainstream media missed. Counterspin exposes and highlights censored stories, sexism, racism, and homophobia in the news, the power of corporate influence, gaffes and goofs by leading TV pundits, and more. That's every Friday at 5:30 p.m. here on your community radio station. KBOO Portland.
Good morning, KBOO listeners. The time is 9 o'clock. I'm Tave Fache Drake. Today's Tuesday, the 22nd of August. I hope you're having a lovely morning. Up in just a few moments after these announcements, Alternative Radio. Yes Magazine co-founder David Corton asks what it will take to lead us towards an ecological civilization. At 10 o'clock, we have Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock, Stage and Studio, Dime Roberts checks in with Damasco Rodriguez of Artist Repertory Theater and their upcoming season, including the likely controversial play, An Octoroom. And then at 11:30 on Art Focus, Eric Bartels welcomes Scott Campbell, who was once known as Extremo the Clown, the offbeat character who ran for mayor and created absurd art cars. But he's also a talented splash painter whose work has adorned local storefronts for decades. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Today's weather calls for a very sunny day with a high around 90. I hope if you were around for the eclipse, it was a lovely and epic one. And stick around today.